You are listening to an ADIS podcast.
I'm glad you can join us for this peer-reviewed publication podcast regarding challenges in C3 glomerulopathy diagnosis, looking at best practices in kidney biopsies. This podcast is being hosted by Advances in Therapy. And for this podcast, our objectives will be to consider the central role of the biopsy in C3 glomerulopathy or C3G diagnosis, to discuss the key histological observations in C3 glomerulopathy, and to review the best practices for kidney biopsy and clinical evaluation to assist with the diagnosis of C3 glomerulopathy from the perspectives of the pathologist and the nephrologist. I'm Richard Lafayette. I'm a professor of medicine at Stanford University Medical Center, where I direct the Glomerular Disease Center. And it's a great pleasure to be here with Dr. Vivek Charu.
Yeah, hi, everyone. I'm Vivek Charu. I'm an assistant professor of pathology and a renal pathologist here at Stanford University.
Fantastic and welcome. I hope for our listeners, this will be an exciting podcast. We really want to look at understanding how we approach C3 glomerulopathy and how important the biopsy is to the diagnosis. And this is sort of in reflection to the fact that things have changed over the last decade, where we used to have diagnoses of broader concepts of disease, such as membranoproliferative glomerular nephritis, confusion between the different patterns, and that a lot of times C3 glomerulopathy was described as an atypical post-infectious glomerulonephritis, and etiology was really, really poorly defined. And more than a decade ago, individual authors started bringing forth the idea that we might be better approaching this based on the immunofluorescence and the presentation that complement is driving some of these diseases. And ultimately, that may lead to a better definition of diagnosis and a better approach to treating our patients. So I think it's very, very exciting. We all know that C3 glomerulopathy itself, once diagnosed, is fairly rare, only occurring in 1 to 2 out of a million individuals on this earth. And that it does seem to be, again, a perfect example of a complement-mediated disease. But the clinical presentations that we'll discuss in a little while are very heterogeneous. Again, it tends to be a progressive disease, and unfortunately, more than half of adults affected by this will progress to kidney failure, needing dialysis or transplant within 10 years. It's also sometimes diagnosed in childhood and adolescence, and as we'll review, children are a little bit more prone to have the dense deposit form rather than the C3GN form. We'll talk about key signs and features that might indicate a C3G diagnosis in the presentation as a nephritic syndrome, but ultimately really want to focus on the biopsy, because for C3G, it is the biopsy that makes the definitive diagnosis and that leads to the differential diagnosis. And I'll break there for a second, just for little introductory remarks from Dr. Charu as well about thinking about the biopsy and how things have changed and how there can be confusion about C3G versus other diseases.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. I think that, as you mentioned, the diagnosis of C3 glomerulopathy and sort of the subdivisions of C3 glomerulopathy into dense deposit disease and C3 glomerulonephritis, or C3GN, has really only occurred in the past 10 to 15 years as a result of all of these clinical pathologic studies that have tried to further characterize the etiology of these diseases. So I think we've tried to move from a morphologic description of a disease process to an etiologic-based description of a disease process. And in this case, the driver of C3 glomerulopathy is activation of the alternative complement pathway. I think some of the key ideas are that these patients can have either like a constitutive activation of the alternative pathway or a blocking or inhibition of some of the inhibitors of the alternative pathway. And so both of those features result in excess activation of the alternative complement pathway, which we see as C3 deposits in the glomeruli.
Yeah, and I think we'll dive deeper into that. And again, it points out that the biopsy is absolutely necessary in these cases because there are all these various presentations with varying degrees of hematuria and proteinuria, varying degrees of presentations with high blood pressure or swelling, with renal dysfunction or not, and sometimes different serologic presentations with either preserved complement levels in the blood or more typically depressed complement levels, particularly the C3 level can often be low. So the biopsy becomes really, really important in sorting out the differential diagnosis. We know that kidney biopsies can be performed in most patients safely as long as patients don't already have end-stage kidney disease, a severe coagulopathy, or really unusual anatomy. We can usually get the kidney biopsy done safely and effectively, then work really carefully together with our pathologists to get a nuanced understanding of the diagnosis and to really get a firm start on knowing exactly what our patients have. So jumping right to an illustrative case that's sort of distilled out of experiences from several cases over the decades, we'll talk about this typical case to really discern what the role of biopsy is and how it can guide clinicians in the best care of our patients. So here we've devised an 18-year-old woman who was generally well. In fact, she had had a couple years of leg swelling that she attributed to her periods and changes in her diet. But on further questioning, she indeed had foamy appearing urine and at intervals had seen discoloration of her urine, which she actually described as sort of dark and Coca-Cola colored. She had histories of intermittent sore throats, but no active infections or fevers. She was a non-smoker, didn't use illicit drugs, and her only relevant family history was her mom having kidney stones. There was no other kidney disease or autoimmune disease. She had clinical findings, which we'll review in a moment, and we undertook a diagnostic kidney biopsy. And in fact, her biopsy findings were confirmed by two later biopsies because she was in a clinical trial, and we were able to do further biopsies just to be sure that we were monitoring the right disease. Her exemplar laboratory tests showed normal kidney function with a creatinine of 0.5 milligrams per deciliter. Her total protein was about 8 grams per deciliter, but her albumin was a little bit low at 3 grams per deciliter. Anti-streptolysin test was done, which was normal, but her C3 levels were indeed very depressed at 15 milligrams per deciliter with a normal C4 level. She was heavily proteinuric at 8 grams per gram, and a serologic test for glomerular disease was undertaken, and her ANCAs were negative, her cryos were normal. She did not have an anti-double-stranded DNA finding, her ANA was normal, and hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV serologies were indeed normal. So we went on to do a kidney biopsy. And Dr. Chara, it'd be great if you just went ahead and described what this typical biopsy showed.
Thanks, Dr. Lafayette. So classic cases of C3G or C3 glomerulonephritis or dense deposit disease by light microscopy show a membranoproliferative pattern glomerulonephritis. And a membranoproliferative pattern glomerulonephritis is characterized by diffuse mesangial and endocapillary hypercellularity, lobular accentuation of the capillary tuft, and glomerular basement membrane double contouring. So this is the classic morphology that has been seen historically in cases of C3G. But over time, we've learned that actually the light microscopic findings in C3G can be quite diverse and can range from just plain mesangial proliferation to more of an endocapillary proliferative glomerulonephritis. Cases can have crescents, active crescents, cellular and fibrous crescents. So really the glomerular changes and the glomerular morphology that's seen by light microscopy can be very heterogeneous. As has been mentioned, C3 glomerulopathy is really divided into two distinct diagnoses, C3 glomerulonephritis or C3GN and dense deposit disease, DDD. And to separate C3GN from DDD really requires both immunofluorescence, but ultimately electron microscopy. And I'll just mention that very well-developed cases of DDD, there can be some subtle findings on light microscopy with sort of thickened or glossy deposits all along the capillary walls. For all of these cases of C3 glomerulopathy, immunofluorescence microscopy is essential to make the diagnosis. So as part of routine processing of kidney biopsies, we perform a set of immunofluorescence studies in which we stain a piece of frozen kidney biopsy tissue with a panel of immune reactants, including IgG, IgA, and IgM heavy chains, kappa and lambda light chains, and C3, specifically C3C, one of the breakdown products of C3, and C1Q. And by definition, cases of C3G must have dominant C3 staining in the glomeruli. And that dominant classification, that dominant staining of C3 must be greater than or equal to 2 orders of magnitude higher than the intensity by immunofluorescence for any of the other immune reactants in the panel. So most classic cases of C3G have only C3 staining in the glomeruli, but there are many cases actually that have dominant C3 staining, but some staining for some of the other immune reactants, including some immunoglobulin staining or even a little bit of C1Q staining. And the presence of other immunoglobulins in cases of bona fide C3 glomerulopathy have been verified through mass spectrometry studies. And there are some findings in immunofluorescence that can, again, be clues to the diagnosis of dense deposit disease versus C3GN. But ultimately, we really rely on electron microscopy to make a definitive diagnosis of dense deposit disease. And that's because the ultrastructural findings in dense deposit disease are so characteristic. And those are characterized by deposition and really transformation of the lamina densa of the glomerular basement membrane by homogeneous, very highly electron dense C3 deposits. And the density, the darkness that we see in those deposits, we often call hyperosmiophilic deposits. And those deposits have sort of a sausage-shaped characteristic, and they're sort of confluent and elongated and linear and all along the glomerular basement membranes. And when we see those, we can feel very confident about making a diagnosis of dense deposit disease. In contrast, C3 glomerulonephritis don't have those very hyper-dense deposits along the glomerular basement membranes. Classic cases of C3 glomerulonephritis demonstrate less dense but clear deposits in the mesangium, subendothelium, and subepithelial distributions. Many cases of C3 glomerulonephritis demonstrate subepithelial humps or bulky subepithelial deposits. In many other cases, distinguishing between C3 glomerulonephritis and dense deposit disease can be quite difficult because there can be a lot of overlapping findings on electron microscopy.
I think that's very helpful. We clinicians rely on the pathologists and their expertise also to dig a little deeper and tell us that it's really not post-infectious or infection-related glomerulonephritis, to see whether or not it might be caused by a monoclonal gammopathy. Can you tell us other features when we see an MPGN pattern with complement and might see these subepithelial humps? You know, it certainly worries us. I'm sure it worries you as well. How do you get further detail to try to differentiate the diagnosis by the pathology?
This really brings up what are the main differential diagnoses that we think about when we're trying to make a diagnosis of C3 glomerulopathy. And the first is infection-associated glomerulonephritis, formerly called post-infectious glomerulonephritis. So ultimately, distinguishing between infection-associated glomerulonephritis and C3G is very, very challenging on the grounds of biopsy alone. And that's because basically the findings can be completely overlapping across light, IF, and EM. Classic cases of infection-associated glomerulonephritis do demonstrate sort of neutrophilic inflammation in the glomeruli. But I think ultimately those cases of infection-associated glomerulonephritis, that's where the clinical pathologic correlation and the clinical presentation and follow-up really help distinguish between the two. The second big differential diagnosis that we think about is actually a membranoproliferative pattern glomerulonephritis with masked monotypic immunoglobulin deposits. And this gets in part to your question about the monoclonal gammopathies. And so actually it's been found in the past, there was a subset of cases that were actually diagnosed as C3G, and that when we perform a particular technique called antigen retrieval on formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue, so that's when we take the formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue and we use a proteolytic digestion and then perform immunofluorescence studies on the formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue, that in a subset of these cases that by routine immunofluorescence microscopy showed only C3 staining, on the antigen retrieval studies actually showed monotypic immunoglobulin deposits in the glomeruli. And this has now become a sort of a routine practice in renal pathology. And we've been able to identify now that there are certain immunoglobulin deposits that are quote unquote masked, meaning that we can't identify them or pick them up on routine immunofluorescence studies, but we require this antigen retrieval technique in order to be able to detect them. And so because of this discovery that actually there were these subset of cases with C3 dominant staining by routine immunofluorescence that turned out to be masked monotypic immunoglobulin deposits, it's become part of our routine processing of these cases. When we see dominant C3 in the glomeruli, we always perform antigen retrieval on the formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue to rule out the possibility of masked monotypic immunoglobulin deposits. And the reason is obviously that those cases with masked monotypic immunoglobulin deposits, we think the real driver of kidney disease is immune complex based as opposed to dysregulation of the alternative complement pathway. So that distinction is actually very important. And that's one distinction where actually we can make a lot of headway on histopathologic grounds alone.
Yeah, and that's extremely helpful when that gets done and brings us in a different direction. As you know, we do our own serologic evaluation typically for C3G cases because there should be an awareness about a link to monoclonal gammopathy, because as you know, sometimes monoclonal proteins can actually act as antibodies against components of the alternate complement pathway, inhibiting inhibitors of the pathway and therefore activating it, or it can directly stimulate components of the complement pathway. We think more typically that these monoclonal proteins can actually have mechanisms to activate the alternate pathway, thus causing the pattern of C3G with alternate pathway damage to the kidney. Clinically, we're often looking for prognosis for our patients as well, and we use clinical patterns. Certainly renal insufficiency, abnormal creatinine is a very worrisome finding. More severe proteinuria above 1 gram and then heavier is worrisome in these patients as well, as is hypertension. But are there pathological patterns that are also associated with prognosis in C3G?
Yeah, so there has been development of a C3 glomerulopathy histopathology index, which is really a set of scores, both activity and chronicity scores, that are actually really meant to mimic the histopathologic scoring system we use in lupus nephritis. So the activity score captures glomerular changes such as mesangial or endocapillary hypercellularity, membranoproliferative pattern morphology, leukocyte infiltration of the glomeruli, whether there's crescents or fibrinoid necrosis, and interstitial inflammation. And the chronicity score, again, mimicking the chronicity score in lupus nephritis, captures the global glomerulosclerosis, interstitial fibrosis, tubular atrophy, and vascular changes. And so since this score was originally proposed in 2018, there have been a couple of validation studies in large cohorts of patients with C3G. And those validation studies have suggested that, as you might expect, the most important prognostic information in the kidney biopsy is really the chronicity score. So the interstitial fibrosis, tubular atrophy, and percentage of global glomerulosclerosis really are what are most predictive of kidney failure. One of those validation studies did also identify the presence of crescents as being prognostic. So I think they fit with what practicing nephrologists already know from the kidney biopsy, but those studies have really validated the role of some of the chronicity indices that we report in the kidney biopsy report as being important prognostically.
And I think all the work from pathologists, from the consensus report, has really led to us really turning this around and understanding this is a truly alternate complement-driven disease. And part of our laboratory evaluation of our patients now typically follows a path to try to find out why the complement is activated. And we depend on our laboratory to evaluate for complement gene abnormalities, although still to date that's found in a minority of patients, but we do look for those complement abnormalities to guide possible transplant donors and family evaluation for risks of disease. We also look for these autoantibodies, which are sometimes called C3 or even C4 nephritic factors, and various antibodies to components of the complement pathway, because they may serve as biomarkers of disease, although not faithfully in study by study, and they may tell us a little bit more about pathophysiology and how to guide treatment. And of course, we do look for abnormalities for monoclonal proteins as well. Any other thoughts about the laboratory evaluation of these patients?
The main thought I have, Dr. Lafayette, is just that to really arrive at an accurate diagnosis does require a lot of clinical pathologic correlation and a lot of communication between the renal pathologist and the nephrologist. And that sometimes, as you know, it can take time from the kidney biopsy in order to get all of the relevant laboratory workup in order to come to a conclusion about what the diagnosis really is for these patients.
Yeah, agreed. And I think it's time that's worthwhile, depending on, again, what we think the prognosis is of the patient, will embark on therapy. And just to quickly mention an approach to a typical patient who you feel the proteinuria is high, where the activity score is high, and there may be some early chronicity, is we would like to treat the patients. We put them on conservative therapy with blood pressure controlling agents and RAS inhibitors. But now the KDIGO guidelines have suggested for patients at worrisome prognosis to move to immunosuppression with, again, varying degrees of agreement in the literature saying that these therapies work, but a trial of immunosuppression such as Cellceptin steroids seems to be indicated. This may work less well in patients who have complement gene defects, but may be worth trying. There's been efforts to use complement inhibitors, particularly C5 inhibitors, again, with mixed results. But the field is really supercharged and very excited by understanding more about the pathophysiology, about the clinical pathologic correlations, about the science, pathophysiologic and pathologic correlations. And we hope to have better therapies and more specific alternate complement pathway blockers in the near future. So let me just conclude. The main points of the conversation are that understanding patients with clinical need for a kidney biopsy should result in a biopsy. Again, there's abundant evidence that for most patients, the kidney biopsy is a safe way forward without a significant complication rate, certainly a manageable complication rate. Again, communication between a nephrologist and the expert nephropathologist is really vital to getting the definitive diagnosis of C3 glomerulopathy and assuring that the differential diagnosis has been fully explored. And that while there's no single algorithm that can identify all cases of C3G, we do rely on our pathologist to give us a sense of how certain the diagnosis is and how far we should go looking for infections or other diseases. There's clearly a strong need to identify other biomarkers and maybe other pathologic histologic characteristics, maybe to improve the separation of C3G from these other diagnostic considerations. But hopefully we'll get there. While this is a rare disease, I think it's maybe a gateway diagnosis where it's the hallmark of alternate complement mediated kidney disease. And we now suspect that numerous different glomerular diseases may have a substantial part of their pathophysiology in complement dysregulation. And perhaps the learnings we get from this disease will help other patients as well. So we'd like to direct the listeners to the accompanying graphical abstract, which should include illustrative staining images, supporting information and references, and a flowchart showing our diagnostic workflow. Thank you very much, Dr. Charu.
Thank you.
You are listening to an ADIS podcast. You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Podcast with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements, please read the article on the journal website.